Welcome to the Jazz Legends Podcast, which was born out of the Jazz Evensong gatherings on Sunday nights at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. Ornette Coleman set the jazz world ablaze with the release of his first recording, Something Else, in 1958. Ironically, so many of the innovations he introduced to the music have become so ingrained over the passing years, it's difficult to believe his music was so controversial at the time. His conception of free jazz influenced mainstream jazz musicians like Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, and Jackie McLean, to name just a few. The knowledgeable jazz musicians you'll hear are Gunner Biggs, Keith Bishop, Joey Carano, Leonard Thompson, and Bob Weller. And the talk is moderated by me, your host, Father Doran Stambaugh. Dig it.
When I lived in New York, it would be about like 87, 1987 or so. I was in a jam session one time, and we were talking on a break, and the guitar player mentioned that he'd just been called by Ornette to go on the road to Europe, do a tour in Europe. And so this guitar player asked Ornette how much the gig paid. And Ornette said, oh, so you're one of them businessmen musicians. So he didn't go. So if it paid anything decent, I'm sure he wouldn't have said that. Hey, who knows? Those things, I don't know. They hardly ever paid enough, it seems like. Hmm.
So Ornette Coleman, he was from Fort Worth, Texas, right? I read that.
And yeah, he was.
He's a little bit like, I don't know, what do you say, like eggnog, like it or don't like it. Not really a lot of in-between. Well, I have a quote here from an interview in the 60s that says that his highly individualistic playing has drawn from musicians and laymen cries ranging from fraud and unbearable nonsense to genius and another bird.
I'm still shocked when I listen to the old records that he supposedly rocked the world with, some of his original records with Don Cherry and Billy Higgins and Charlie Hayden, that they created so much controversy, because they don't sound that far out to me these days.
Yeah, I agree. They're totally listenable, and the sounds are nice and organic, and tunes there with intervals and stuff, and yes, it's pretty free, and they're loose with the unison playing and stuff, but yeah, I don't think.
And you can definitely tell he's coming out of Bird. He's playing a lot of the same kind of material that Bird played, but just in a different context. And maybe he doesn't play the saxophone as well as Charlie Parker played it, because he's sort of in the crack sometimes. They like to say it's organic sounding, but I just like to say maybe he doesn't play the saxophone as well as Bird did.
Was he playing the plastic horn at that time?
He might have been playing the plastic horn. He's kind of infamous for playing this white plastic Grafton saxophone for the beginning of his career. But the funny thing is, like, he plays on towards the end of his career, he played on a Selmer metal saxophone, normal metal saxophone, but he had it lacquered white, so a lot of people think, oh, he's still playing that plastic, white plastic saxophone, but he wasn't. But he was kind of eccentric anyhow. He also tried to play the trumpet and the violin later in his career, and he really probably shouldn't have done that.
Well, he was eccentric in Fort Worth, too. He used to have really long hair and a beard, and for a young black man in Texas. At that time, he was really ostracized just for his general appearance. So he started out on the outside.
Yeah.
Kind of found his way in.
You kind of have to wonder if it was like a purposeful thing to try and like make a statement of some kind. But there are these weird stories, like when he was playing at the Five Spot in New York, people would go because it was like some kind of a freak show. And it was pretty normal sounding music from the recordings that I've heard. But I heard this story that one night Leonard Bernstein came in and got like laid like under the bass, as close as he could get to the bass to like try and catch the vibes or some kind of nonsense. I think Leonard might have been high too, but whatever.
So growing up in Fort Worth, one of the anecdotes I read reading up on him was that the high school where he attended, he participated in the band until he was dismissed for improvising during the Washington Post march.
You guys heard? I wouldn't be surprised.
It sounds like he's been a free thinker and free player from the very beginning. But what can you say about, did he know how to play? You know,
I think he definitely knew how to play.
You mean work the machine? Yeah, he was a... He was a technician. He had some stuff going on.
I mean, that's evidenced alone by whether you're into the way he improvises or not. I mean, those records and records of material that he put out, just the heads.
Difficult.
The heads alone are
really hard.
You know, there's a lot of material in these lines that he's playing in unison with the trumpet player Don Cherry, that weren't just random throwing paint on a wall. You know, I'm sure it took a lot of effort. And apparently those, I don't know what you guys know about this, and I can't remember where I read it, but some of those early L.A. bands with, you know, Billy Higgins and Charlie, I guess those guys rehearsed a lot. Didn't they rehearse all day, apparently?
Oh, that's what I'd heard, yeah.
Which is really cool because...
And the music really that they made wasn't free. They pretty much centered on some tonal centers that they maybe not didn't talk about it, but they ended up playing in a key.
Yeah, even the middle of the tune after they stated the head, even though that was pretty open, like you said, it wasn't even probably... harmonically left a chance. I mean, like you said, there was still probably a tonal center, you know, in mind for a lot of that stuff.
But, and it's obvious that they rehearsed together because they played together, and it sounded like it was a cohesive musical thing.
And when I think about that process that happened with those guys, apparently it's kind of cool because that's more of like a model for like a pop band or a rock band. Mm-hmm. It's just some guys getting together and they want to create something and put some work into it, and maybe some people will appreciate it, you know.
I think
not any less valid, but it's just an interesting way that they developed their thing. Kind of cool, I thought.
I think our band we performed some Ornette stuff once. We kind of exemplified the experimental end of things with playing that much. In our experience the other few weeks or about months ago when we were doing some Ornette stuff, there was a cross signal on what tune we were going to be doing next. And for that tune, the band was playing two different tunes at the same time. And while I'm doing it, I knew something was different, but it's Ornette, right? And I'm going, wow, this is really kind of cool. And then we realized that half of us were playing one song and the other half were playing another. But Ornette probably would have been out there. Yeah. You know, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, I ask, that's probably a horrible question to ask, could he play? Who am I to ask that of this guy? But I'm reading his, in his history, like early on, it said that he would get kicked out of the jam sessions or the club owners didn't like him, talking about how he couldn't play. So that was other people's perception. And even like here's a downbeat quote where he says, he wrote and played at home in the early days because most musicians didn't take to me. They said I didn't know the changes and was out of tune. And so, you know, I mean, that's part of the question is, did he know the changes and was he in tune? You know, it's that inside outside thing of like, could he do it and he was choosing not to, or was he struggling to figure something out and then he legitimately found his own creative voice? There's no question about his creativity, it seems. And his ability to express himself with force and power and all these things that people say. But could he also just sit in and play with?
I think he wasn't really like a flexible musician that could go with somebody else's thing. I think people had to go with his thing.
Got it.
And that was basically why people like didn't go with it, because it's like, I don't hear where he's going with that, so I'm not going to try and go with him.
But he could also be right in the pocket, like Lonely Woman, that tune. Yeah. I mean, not necessarily pocket, but that's a gorgeous melody. I mean,
yes.
So he had that side of him too, a very lyric quality to some things.
And I think he was really fortunate to have people like Charlie Hayden and Billy Higgins and Don Cherry around him, because they were sensitive to what he was doing, and they're such great players in so many different styles that they could make him sound good. Not that he wasn't going to sound good, but they really accommodated what he was trying to do. It was a great band.
Doran, you asked, like, oh, could he play over changes? And I think from everything I've heard from him and about him, he would probably be the first to tell you that he had no interest in learning to play over changes. Like, his whole thing, whatever it was, and that's a whole nother talk, like, what is harmelotics? And that's,
so that was,
you know,
question,
that's an hour-long discussion that probably no one knows. I guess, I don't know. It's a mysterious thing, and he talks in mysterious ways, but I guess the one thing the way you could start defining it is what is it not, maybe? And it's definitely not about playing over a sequence of chord changes, you know? Yeah, my journey with him is that it's taken me, you know, until the past 5 or 10 years to really listen to him some and really appreciate it. But I really like appreciate, you know, the piece of the puzzle that he is. And I don't know. For me, the best way to look at him is like, this is a guy who landed from outer space, and get rid of everything all the words you know and what's jazz and what is a saxophone and what should a saxophone do. He's just like pure art that sort of landed in the world and says, what is this? What can I do with it? No preconceptions, no rules. And I think he was doing it like very honestly, you know, and I think that's, you know, maybe one of the most important things that an artist can do. It seemed genuine, you know.
And I think part of what makes accessible is he's got a really strong affinity for the blues and the blues conception when he plays. So that makes his music, even if it's as out as it is, a lot more accessible for me, at least.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate what you said, Leonard. That was a good articulation of him as an artist. Not a jazz musician, but truly one of a kind, unique, creative. Gary Giddens in his Visions of Jazz says, I guess this is a personal comment, says, the music hits me in unprotected areas of the brain, areas that remain raw and impressionable. In short, they continue to make, I guess his tunes, continue to make terrible background music, thank God. They command full attention, and at that price are immensely pleasurable. I think I would say that about actually a lot of jazz for me. I've learned I can't put it on and go into the kitchen and make dinner. I've realized that about jazz. It demands my attention. And I think especially for something like Ornette. I mean,
you could use Kenny G for making
Kenny
dinner.
Kenny G for dinner.
That's really good.
He did a strings composition that was recorded in the UK later in his life that I tried to listen to, and when my daughter came out of the room, like, wanted to see if everything was okay. It was really...
I heard a story, The Skies of America was one of the ones that he wrote.
That was it, Skies of America.
And I heard, I don't know whether it's true, but we showed up at the recording session, and all the parts were written in alto key.
Mm. Oh,
and they just, it still sounded like it, you know, whatever it was. It was a bizarre sounding thing. And that's when he said, it's the harmonic system. It's just... Go with it, man. It's cool.
You were like, on that date?
No, I wasn't. Oh. I heard the story that like he didn't realize that the different instruments were transposed differently or
all right,
whatever. And he still was going to go with it. No, don't worry about it. Just play it. It's fine.
Well, you know, if you want to do the normal comparison with music history and art history, you know, they label the periods the same, classical, Renaissance, etc. Jackson Pollock did the cover art on Free Jazz.
Oh, wild.
And I bought that as a kid because I liked the cover. Yeah. And it said jazz. Yeah. I was like 14 or 15. And I put it on and I'm going, whoa. But I'm looking at the cover and I heard the Jackson Pollock influence. And that's a perfect complementary totally. Image to go with that sonic fabric that he was working.
And I understand he and some of those other artists in that school used to go hang out at the Five Spot and listen to Ornette too. So.
And, you know, he's huge in Europe, always was, still is. And talking to a German fellow, and he said, you guys have it all wrong. All you're doing is rehashing standards, maybe playing them faster, maybe playing them in different keys. True improvisation is playing an instrument you have never played before. Okay. That's the only true improvisation.
I guess that would be
because
true.
You have to make discoveries with every note.
It has but you don't have to share them.
That's true. Well, I'm not saying that's my opinion.
I'm just joking.
That's why the Europeans are very critical of the American jazz, the way it's gone, like the Wynton Marsalis neo-traditional kind of thing.
Well, I remember hearing an interview of an architect, I think, or maybe a art critic, I'm not sure, but they were talking about this architect, Gehry, is it Phil Gehry?
Frank Gehry,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
And the one critic was saying, art should not serve a function, and once it serves a function, it ceases to be art. And I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting thing to think about if you want to talk about pure art, but I mean, what is pure art? Because even a Pollock painting is sitting there on the wall, and it's serving a function, right? Music certainly does. Most of the time, it's a functional art form. But so many times, producers of records, the big machine, they want to, like with pop music, this works, this sells, and we're trying to sell records, so we can't be bothered with something that might be interesting artistically until it starts to make money. But there was a time, because I also think, you know, the modern jazz quartet piano player, John
Lewis.
Lewis, I think he also championed Ornette Coleman. And yeah. And he's a very different improvising musician.
Yeah. Mind-blowing to hear about that connection.
And yeah, because John Lewis was such practically a classical guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Third stream.
And after listening to these old records, I can see why, because I don't think they sound that weird myself.
I haven't either.
It's hard for me to believe that it was such a controversy. But then on the other hand, it seems like in years after that, the jazz community just went off the deep end. Like anybody, whether they could even play their instruments or not, this guy's a genius. We're going to let him make this record. And you'd hear the record, you go, what the hell are they doing? You know. Yeah.
Like, well, the album Free Jazz, I read that he named the album Free Jazz, but it wasn't the goal was not to create a new genre, even though that kind of did that create a new genre. Did it? I mean, do you?
Well, a lot of people, I think, were trying to follow in his footsteps and got completely misguided myself. Mm-hmm. There was a whole group, you know, a bunch of people playing in the 60s that when I'd hear them, I'd go, what is going on with this?
Here's a story about Ornette on learning that Coleman didn't count off tempos. An astonished George Russell inquired, how did that work? Insight, Coleman said. When you guys play, are you going to count off the tunes? Or
I think so, yeah.
We did. Yeah. last time we did, we counted off everything.
Are we going to count off the same tunes?
Yeah. Not count off one, at least.
When you guys play, because we've done Ornette before.
Well, we played Lonely Lady sort of out of tempo. I don't think we really had a tempo.
Yeah. Yeah, that was real rubato.
They're palatable.
Well, I tried to pick ones that we could play with piano that had chords for the most part.
Yeah, like it's going to make any difference that I have a part in front of me.
Well, no, you did. You know, there were a couple.
Oh,
some
right.
Of those
you played keys on that.
Pretty much bebop tunes. Yeah. You know.
I want to say, Father Dorn said after that gig, I was playing piano on that. He said, you know, Bob, it's interesting listening to you. You have no filter. You know?
Awesome.
No filter.
Well, thank you.
I think piano playing harmonically also. Yeah. I mean,
well, or not playing. Like
and, yeah. If anyone dares to try, I mean, what would you suggest that they have a go at, listen to for a first taste for Ornette?
Well, The Shape of Jazz to Come, which I think is very accessible.
Yeah, Shape
start
of Jazz
easy,
to Come.
Move into it.
I think the other cool thing about Ornette, I think, from my experience, is quote-unquote free as it all is, if you listen to those first few albums, like there's a remarkable sort of continuity in his basic approach that you can really sort of get a hold on. I kind of put a lot of those first few albums in the same bunch, and what are the other ones? Tomorrow is the Question, mm-hmm. and Shape of Jazz to Come.
New York is Now is another one that I really like because it has Elvin Jones on it and Jimmy Garrison, who were the half of the quartet that John Coltrane had for years. So they're coming from sort of that tradition, which was influenced by Ornette, but it kind of drags Ornette back into like their sphere, which is kind of a cool thing. And it also has Dewey Redman on it.
And just the tune Lonely Woman, I think, is a good good song because it's very pretty. Yeah.
Did you ever hear the band Old New Dreams?
Yeah.
That was Ornette's band without Ornette. Mm-hmm. I heard them once and with Dewey Redman and Don Cherry.
Yeah.
And it was still Ornette. It was Ed Blackwell as well.
Oh, yeah.
So it was the band without Ornette. So if you get Old New Dreams, you're going to get a taste of what they took from Ornette and how they presented that.
It's interesting, too, to hear Sonny Rollins' records he made with Don Cherry, because Don Cherry is kind of dragging him in that direction. And it's an interesting mixture of chemistries.
Yeah.
Has anybody see him live? Any personal connection or experience?
Well, Old New Dreams is his band, so that's the closest I got, except for Dewey Redman, who's Joshua Redman's dad. So, but they were playing Ornette style.
That's the closest you got
to Ornette.
Oh, you saw that?
He wasn't in the band. It was his band minus Ornette. Yeah.
Got it.
I was told that he played at UCSD once, and I'm assuming this is somewhere in the 80s. And half the folks left at the break, and apparently at one point somebody yelled out, "Play Cherokee." And he did. He quoted it somewhere in the middle. And,
at UCSD?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he was on Saturday Night Live once.
Oh, I didn't know that.
As the musical guest?
They used to have some really interesting. Sun Ra was on Saturday Night Live once.
Oh, I need
back
to look
when
that
they
up.
Used to have like that Canadian guy that became a film writer after that was leading the band. And they used to ask him who they'd get, and they had interesting stuff like Ornette.
Wild.
The Evensong Quintet will play many of Ornette Coleman's compositions that have become jazz standards, including Lonely Woman, The Blessing, and Turnaround, along with many others from this creative artist, on March 17th starting at 4 p.m. The weekly Jazz Evensong gatherings are free and open to the public and take place Sundays at 4 p.m. at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. See you there.